Good evening. I'm Brian Meyer. I'm news director at WBFO, and I am thrilled to welcome you tonight to WNED WBFO to record a segment of The Takeaway and to get to know the host. And we've had the pleasure at WBFO of doing that this morning. They arrived at 6:15, and we've had some wonderful conversations. It's a long day for broadcasters. This event would not be possible without the support of our sponsors, Buffalo Seminary and Roger Torrey Peterson Institute of Natural History. We thank them. We do have a few housekeeping items we have to talk about before we get to this excellent panel. First of all, please silence your cell phones. Keep in mind that a segment of this is going to be airing on The Takeaway tomorrow. So if your spouse or child or aunt calls, 2.5 million people will hear that, okay? So that's 290-some stations, so please make sure your cell phones are silenced. Also, there are restrooms located in the hall outside of the studio. Volunteers will be on hand to help direct you if you need to. We ask you, though, to use the back entrance or the entrance over here, not this one over here, which has now disappeared. That's wonderful. I really am very, very, very pleased to introduce this distinguished panel of guests. We're very, very pleased to have them here tonight. Eva Hassett is Executive Director of the International Institute of Buffalo, a position she's held since 2009. The International Institute seeks to make Western New York a better place for and a better place because of immigrants and refugees. Welcome, Eva. Ayla Abiad is a Buffalo-based architect who was born and raised in Damascus. She holds a bachelor's degree in architecture from Private University of Science and Art in Aleppo, Syria. She came to the U.S. in 2009 to achieve higher education and is interested in sustainable and environmental architecture. We're thrilled to have you here. Thank you so much, Ayla.
Thank you.
And right next to me is Larry Crist. He's the Chief Operating Officer of Light Lab Corp, a global specialty lighting manufacturer. We learned some interesting facts about this company a little earlier. Light Lab is committed to hiring from within the immigrant and refugee communities. Currently, about 18% of its employees are immigrants or refugees from more than a dozen nations. Thank you, Larry. Appreciate you coming. And finally, John Hockenberry. A three-time Peabody Award winner, four-time Emmy winner, John has broad experience as a journalist and commentator. He's reported from literally all over the world across multiple media platforms. John joined NBC as a correspondent. You can probably name the show, Dateline NBC, right? We've saw him for a long time. He basically joined in 1996 after a 15-year career in broadcast news at National Public Radio and ABC News. In 2009, he was appointed to the White House Fellows Commission by President Obama. He's written for countless news publications and is a published author, having written a novel and his own memoir. John is currently, of course, host of the very popular Takeaway program. John, thanks so much for coming to Buffalo. And without further ado, I will hand things over to John Hockenberry, and I'll see you back up here in a few minutes.
Thank you so much, Brian. So I want to do one thing before we begin our discussion. I want to recognize my very fine collaborator and producer, Amber, who I believe is here. Amber, you want to stand? Yeah. Amber is a fantastic producer. She and I have been all over the United States doing these kinds of shows and events where we interact with communities and really make the point that public radio is an invitation for everyone to be in a conversation. And it doesn't matter where we are or who you are or what neighborhood you come from or what community you come from, that invitation is open. I also want to welcome and thank my brothers and sisters in the disability community for coming out. You can always... they give the biggest laughs, and they always laughed at the tasteless disability jokes that I'm likely to tell, and all of you know that. But anyway, it's great to have you guys here. I didn't wear shoes because I forgot them. It's not that. I turned 60 this year, and I'll tell you everything. The warranty went off on everything on my body, for heaven's sake. I'm dealing with some issues on my feet and lower extremities, and my shoes don't fit, so I decided, hey, I'll just wear some formal-looking socks here. These are Brooks Brothers. They're very nice. Yep. Years ago, when I was a teenager, right after my accident, I used to go around as this kind of radical. A lot of people who get spinal cord injuries, start out as these kind of, I can do anything. I don't need any help. Don't look at me, man, you know. And I was, like that. And for a while, I actually thought, I don't need to wear your damn shoes, you know, you repressive walking people, you know. I'm free to go around in socks. And I actually did go around in socks when I lived in the Pacific Northwest. I was a reporter and roll around in socks. And when I got my first job as a newscaster at All Things Considered, it was a very lucky break for me at age 23. I remember my news director at KLCC in Eugene, Oregon. The first thing he said to me was, congratulations, but you're going to have to buy some shoes now. And I said, what? You know, he said, yeah, you'll figure it out. And I did. I've got a lot of shoes. Anyway, welcome to the panel.
Thank you.
To all three of you, you represent different perspectives, different looks, different aspects of the immigrant experience in the United States, both on the receiving end and for you on the experiential end of coming to the United States. Ayla, let's just begin with you. Is America a welcoming country?
Yes, it is. It was a wonderful experience for me so far, and I met a lot of supportive people, especially in Buffalo, starting from the International Institute to UB to my previous job at the Center of Computational Research to my current employer, Wendell, who sponsored my green card. And I've met a lot of supportive people along the way so far. So,
and would you say that, when you came here, that you expected to become a more or less permanent citizen of the United States, or did you have a different plan?
No. The plan was for me to come and obtain my higher education, and the plan was to go back and give back to my country. But then the war started, and I had to create a plan B that I didn't have before. So I started talking to my employer, and I suggested that they can sponsor my green card, and they were sure. And the email, the answer in my email, yes, you have my full support. And we started, and they paid for the lawyer, and I have my green card now.
Can we embarrass you?
Sure.
How's her English? No. But she's got a master's in architecture, so there's no reason to patronize someone who speaks so well. You have really accomplished a lot and have gone through a lot of hoops to be here permanently.
Yeah.
How would you say your sense of the difficulty and the sense of welcoming in the United States has changed as the war in Syria has gone on, as the refugee crisis has escalated throughout the world, and as the rhetoric in the United States seems to have changed? How is worries about your family, worries about you, how has that changed for you personally?
Well, when I first came here, French was my second language at school, so I had to learn English, and I had to pass exams in terms of obstacles getting to where I wanted to be. And then when I got my master's degree, I felt like I have the thing that gonna make me go through this. And
you thought you were out of the woods. I mean, you thought,
yeah,
master's, I'm done. I'm clear.
Yes. But then I didn't feel any obstacles until I started looking for a permanent residency. My stay in the United States was threatened at some point. I was on TPS, which is temporary protected status, because of the war in my country. I was a student, and then you get 1 year of optional training practice, and then you're out. So, and I had nowhere to go back to, so I had to investigate in ways where I can stay. Then my employer was supportive. However, I was 30 days close to obtaining my green card, where the ban happened, and everything was on hold. I had 2 months to stay in the United States, or I will be illegal. So these kind of daily pressures, that it's an extra burden that you have to deal with, having been born in the Middle East.
What do you think about when you lie awake at night knowing that the clock is ticking and you really
It was scary. Yeah. It was super scary because my family's here. My son is an American citizen, you know. He was born in here. My mom is an American. She got cleared like a few months ago. So for me, it was like, okay, what are we going to do? And it was a daily struggle for me and my husband figuring out and trying to find employers and how are we going to get through this? We paid a lot of money for lawyers. That's I can tell you for sure. But we got through this, and not a lot of people had the positive outcome, you know. A lot of people were struggling. A lot of people were banned outside. Like, they were stopped in Dubai airport or Doha airport or Egypt. Or not a lot of people were able to have the happy ending that I was fortunate to have.
And just to conclude, you know, everybody knows here in Buffalo about the Peace Bridge.
Yes.
Going to Canada.
Yes.
But for you, it maybe doesn't seem so peaceful.
Well, Buffalo always has been a peaceful place. It's very nice and quiet, and it's different. It's way different than the planet that I came from. For me, it was a challenge to cross the bridge because you'll be risking your career, your family, your everything. Even though I'm a legal I'm a legal permanent resident, it was I wouldn't risk my career.
It's rolling the dice.
Yes.
They're actually thinking of changing the name of the Peace Bridge to the Pain in the Ass Bridge. that's you didn't hear that from me. So Buffalo's a welcoming community, but some people in the national audience might think, Isla, she's done so much work, but she's landed in Buffalo. Oh, how sad for her. But Eva, describe how this community is, in fact, quite unique, and for all of the economic problems, I mean, it's one of the top five poor communities in the United States, but still, for immigrants, there are a lot of opportunities here.
Well, I think Buffalo has earned and has a great reputation as a place for refugees and immigrants to come start a life in America. In fact, I wouldn't be sitting here if Buffalo wasn't, many of us wouldn't be sitting here if Buffalo wasn't a great place for people to start a life. I think we are a welcoming community. And I think also we realize the positive impact that refugees and immigrants are having on our economy, on our neighborhoods, on our understanding of what's going on in the world. And for me, has had a serious effect on my understanding of the advantages that I have as an American. I have the ability to vote. I have the ability to dissent with my government, to stand with a sign on the corner and say whatever I want, to practice a religion or no religion. And not everybody in the world has that, has those rights or those choices. And so I really think that it has helped me, and I think it helps many Buffalonians understand how lucky we are.
As someone with the Joint Commission and also who's been in city politics before, structurally, how does that work in this community? There's a traditionally shrinking population in Buffalo, but yet there's a kind of a boom for immigrants and immigrant work opportunities. Where do they fit into the economy? And is it all levels, or is it grocery stores, or what are we talking about here?
Well, I think, you know, for me it's a truism that you can't have a growing economy if you don't have a growing population. If you don't have a growing population, you don't have a growing workforce, so you don't have employees that employers can hire. If you don't have a growing population, you don't have customers for the businesses or consumers for the services. So those companies that sell product or provide services don't have anybody to sell them to. If you don't have a growing economy, you don't have homeowners. So you can't have strong neighborhoods. If you don't have a growing economy, if a growing population, you don't have taxpayers. So the government that has to provide public safety services and infrastructure services doesn't have the money that it needs to do that. So in order to grow your economy, you need to grow your population. What we know nationally and it's also true in Buffalo, is that the fastest growing population is the immigrant population. And in Buffalo, for as long as I've been alive, every 10 years when we have the census, we all kind of wait to hear how many people, how much smaller we are, how many people have left. But what we're beginning to see, and it hasn't turned around yet in Buffalo, but it's turned around in a lot of places in this country, is that the immigrant population is growing so fast that it is outpacing the shrinkage in the native-born population. And so in Buffalo, I think between 2000 and 2014, the immigrant population grew by more than 32%. The native-born population shrank by 5%. Mm. And so while we're still shrinking, we're shrinking more slowly. And the mayor of Buffalo is saying that he's projecting a change to growth in the 2020 census, which I think is going to be the first time in 70 years that the city has grown. And that will be because of immigrants. So you can't grow your population without immigrants, and you can't grow your economy without population.
Are people finding opportunities at all levels of the economy? There's always talk about the, you know, Bill Gateses of the world who want to bring in people from Bangalore on H-1Bs, but it's not just the Silicon Valley that has those opportunities.
Immigrants and refugees are not a monolith, right? We see it right here today. So immigrants and refugees are working in entry-level jobs, are working in, you know, jobs up and down the skill ladder. One of the really pressing issues, I think, for Buffalo and for the country as a whole is figuring out how to be more supportive of those foreign-educated immigrants who are especially doctors, nurses, teachers, because we have shortages of all those professionals in Buffalo and in this country, and yet we don't have a very good system. Isla is an example of the architecture version, but, you know, imagine if we could address our physician shortage by helping speed up the rate at which a foreign-trained physician. We've had clients at the International Institute who are refugees who are doctors in Burma, who were engineers in Iraq, but they can't be doctors or engineers here, and that's precisely at a time when we don't have enough doctors.
Although the track to be a doctor or an engineer here is probably faster than the, you know, engineer or doctor, you hear the story all the time in New York City, who's an Uber driver,
right,
you know, who doesn't have the ability to get into that profession. But here in Buffalo, it would be quicker.
Well, I think it's interesting you mentioned that. There was a study that came out in December that for the first time put a number on what are we losing, what is that person losing who's an Uber driver instead of a doctor, what are we losing? And the number nationally, the difference in wages that that person earning as a taxi driver and earning as a physician, $39 billion nationally.
Well, that's a very significant
in
number.
New York State, $5 billion from the underemployment or unemployment of college-educated immigrants in professional fields. $5 billion in lost wages, that's a lot of economic impact, and I think it translates into almost $600 million in tax revenue. Hmm. That's a lot of tax revenue. And so everybody needs that, right? And on top of it all, we have a teacher shortage. We have a doctor shortage. We have a nurse shortage. Maine just started to try to, I mean, you can do this. States are working on it. Maine just made a system for turning immigrants into EMTs. Because in Maine, which is largely rural, that's really healthcare. EMTs are an important,
there's a big need.
Right? So what they're doing, and if you can't get to the doctor license yet, at least you could read an EKG or you can be supportive somehow. So it's really interesting to watch states sort of coming to figure this out. New York State hasn't quite yet.
Well, on that note, Eva, as you can imagine, has lots to say on the policy implications of all those numbers and the opportunities that exist for both a community like Buffalo and a state like New York. But let's just march over and talk to Larry here. You're a part of the new manufacturing sector in the United States. Your business is, right?
Well, we've been in business for about 45 years.
But in many ways, you're clean, you're sustainable, you're also very high tech.
Indeed.
Right. I mean, you got your start in the disco days, right? Right.
Yes.
Some people would say the disco is not so clean, but it's not an environmental problem. It's another issue, right?
I think so.
Yeah. So today, you have found that your workforce can really take advantage of some of the things that Eva is talking about here. How do you orient your employment strategy to come up with this 18% figure that Brian mentioned?
I think we have a pragmatic view, John. We have looked at all sorts of ways of hiring people and what would fit best for us. Experience, history, but we found one thing that seems to be tried and true. Look for character and attitude. And if you look for character and attitude, honesty, integrity, hard work, ambition, being accountable, being a developer, achiever, and thinking of continuous improvement, there are some pointers to what we think might be successful employment.
And you find that among the jihadists and gang members and drug cartel members who come across the border?
I don't.
That's the rhetoric. The rhetoric.
Well, I look at immigrants and refugees, not in fear, but in confidence and confident that they will make my business better. And I will tell you, John, why. Because we have people that have come for interviews where they've ridden a bike in the winter from the west side of Buffalo. And on the bike, they'll have a dish drying rack attached where they've put their clothing or some paperwork to come for the interview. We have people that have been in Burmese villages where the government has come in when there's guerrilla forces, and we have a person that now works for us where he's lost his wife and his two children. We have another individual that works for us that was on an Iraqi warship that was sunk by the United States. He's one of nine people that have survived. He works for us. We had a gentleman that came for an interview. He was 20 years old. He was the head of the household because both his parents were disabled and they couldn't work. We take him home to his house. He's just arrived and he has one lamp. The parents come to the door and they have one lamp to go from room to room. If that isn't a resume for somebody that I want to talk to that's going to make my company better, I don't know what is.
So what makes you mad about what we've heard in the 2016 election campaign and how this idea of give me, you're tired, you're poor has turned around to some other sense of American security?
What makes me very angry is this. I believe in the power of humans to change a company, a community, a country. And if you look at all those things that I described, and there's many, many more, that's what America was. Those are the talents that got us to where we are. I believe we've now cast that aside. And I think we've moved to nationalism over patriotism because those ingrained precepts, some of which I've talked about, are the things that we thought were most patriotic. That's what I want to welcome. I don't want to live in fear. I want to live in the confidence of people coming here and making my company, my community, my country better.
One more thing. I had a feeling. I had a feeling you'd get an applause on those lines. Larry, how does it work on your, I don't know if it's a factory floor or is it a factory?
Yes.
It's a factory. How does it work on the factory floor? How do people assimilate? And is there a sense of community among people who come from these faraway places and have these stories and regular Buffalonians who eat wings and are heartbroken by the bills and can't get away from the Buffalo Sabres?
Well, on the factory floor, we really can't help the bills, but we can try to make great lighting. But how it works is this. There's many soft things that happen. We have about 12 countries that people are from. On one production floor, we have seven languages spoken. So what happens is, how do you find that common denominator? for us to ensure quality and make Light Lab a better place. It changes the way we instill instructions, the way we teach, the way we intermingle. But what the amazing part is that we have people that come with a global view, a diversity, a different religion, that have broadened our perspective, Provincial Buffalo's perspective about the world. We do business in the around the globe, and it's helped us. And then the amazing overflow of help from our employees, where they've taken pride in our city. They will help somebody. Somebody needs furniture. Somebody needs clothing. Somebody needs to learn the bus system better. All that wells up, and we become a team, a different team, a multicultural team. It's an amazing thing. It's really heartwarming. And if you believe, as I do, that humans can change your company, I can't ask for more than that.
Wow. And we should not forget that, you know, Provincial Buffalo was, at the turn of the 20th century, a global city, a global industrial city that was on its way to surpassing Chicago, it thought, and things changed. And that's true for a lot of communities in the United States. I interviewed a teacher today who is responsible for English language training in the school system here in Buffalo, and the system she described and the commitment she described to that English learning is just an engine of infrastructure that supports young people coming in to this community with the idea that a place is going to be made for them. That feels strategic to me, Eva. What do you think is missing from this community's sense of attracting and really intentionally going for a lot of these immigrant opportunities that are out there?
Well, I think, as I said, we have a great reputation, and I think that great reputation is comprised of lots of people, you know, employers and institutional leadership, elected leadership. So I think we are moving to be strategic. I think that we could always be more strategic. One of the things that I think about is if you looked at the U.S. as a whole, there are many, many, many states whose governors have said, we don't want any refugees, we don't want any, we're having a moratorium, no more, thank you. And I believe, because I believe so strongly in the economic power of immigrants and refugees and the human power of immigrants and refugees, that this creates an opportunity for places like Buffalo, for states like New York, who places like Buffalo, we need the population. We need the impact, right? We want to grow, and we want to grow so we can grow our economy for all of us. We want all of our employers to be successful so that more employers will come. So I think that creates a recruiting opportunity for us. I watch California is really working hard. Governor Brown in California created an Office of Immigrant Integration in his executive chamber. So I think California is trying to be more strategic. Cities like Philadelphia and Pittsburgh and Detroit and St. Louis and every city in Ohio now have efforts to attract and support immigrants and refugees coming to those cities. I think because they see the same thing. So I think there's an opportunity to be strategic. I think there's competition too, and competition always makes me want to work harder. So that's why I think we need to work harder.
Ayla, where is that part of your mission of giving back to Syria? I would say you studied architecture in Aleppo. Without speaking about the difficulties now and the horrible sense that there really still is no light at the end of the tunnel for the civil war, at some point there's going to be a lot of architecture to do in Aleppo. Do you think about that?
Of course, all the time. I daydream about going back to my country, even though Buffalo is now my second home. I lived third of my life in Buffalo now. It's been since 2009, so you do the math about my age.
There's a prize for somebody who does that.
So I always dream about going and give back to my country, and I believe at some point there will be a lot of opportunity to rebuild, because you see the horrible, heartbreaking pictures of, like, destroyed infrastructure, leveled neighborhoods. How is that going to happen, and when? This is a big question mark in my head. I don't have an answer. I don't believe any political leader or anything that have a straightforward answer to what's going to happen and when in Syria. This is why my plan is to give back to Buffalo, because Buffalo gave me a lot. I feel Buffalo gave me back my wings, and now I feel I can do anything. And as part of that, I try as much as I can to contribute building my community. In my case, literally, doing buildings and designs. I try to give back to the community, the International Institute. I try to volunteer my time to help newly coming refugees and Syrian family to integrate faster, because I believe the faster refugees and immigrants integrate, the faster they can give back. And I believe that the International Institute and Buffalo in general, there's a lot going on in that effort, and I appreciate that. My son is Buffalonian, so I don't know if I'm when I would be going back to my country.
But you raise a point that Larry alluded to a moment ago, and we talk about immigrants and refugees almost exclusively from the perspective of they're coming here and this is a sanctuary and they're going to take advantage of things here in the United States and have a life, as you've certainly managed to do here, Ayla. But it is also the case that America's face on the world is, it's a troublesome identity now. I think, if you think of the George W. Bush years and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and I think less so in the Obama years, but, during the Obama years, we've had a war in Yemen, and, in many ways, we're helping to sustain a famine in Yemen, and Americans don't really know about that, but yet there are millions of people who see the consequences of our foreign policy. You travel all over the world. Your products are in museums and places all over the world. It sounds like your workforce is getting the benefit of this sort of out-of-the-bubble expertise that immigrants give. I mean, I'm wondering if that helps your business, if that is a selling point for installations you might do in Abu Dhabi or Qatar or something like that. I mean, when will the face of America be Isla's face, for instance, and some others? It's coming.
I think we haven't used it as a selling point. Hopefully it would bubble up from who we are and what we stand for. I must say, in traveling around the world, the hardest explanation I have is explaining what direction America is headed. They understand my company, its functions, but where we stand as a country. So I think I owe it to those that I'm involved with at home and those customers that I talk to. I need to tell them what we stand for and hope they will judge us on that and try to put it into the context of America and democracy, and currently we're going through a stage that I personally don't agree with, but they might be able to find a way of understanding where we are as a country and in my company.
I want to give everyone a chance to say everything that they want, and I know you have a lot to say, Eva, but let me do something here that's a little fun. Let's imagine, and this will allow you to say a lot here, I think. Let's imagine that the president is coming to town and has requested a dinner with some folks who represent a diversity in the community, particularly on the issue of immigration and refugee success in Buffalo. Let's say the three of you are heading up the committee to have that dinner here. Can you speak now? Who would you invite? What would you have? What's on the table? What's that experience going to be like? And Eva, you're the chair of the committee, so let's go for it.
I would invite...
No, speak to your committee.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
So I think for food, we take the International Institute's Map for Adventurous Eaters, and we get something, which is a real thing, and we get something from each of the ethnic restaurants that are on that map for food. So we have as many different kinds of ethnic food as we possibly can. And I think we should ask everybody that comes to the dinner to talk about their ancestry, especially the people who were born here. You know, I have to say, I think about the rhetoric and this, you know, this hate stuff or whatever we're talking about with in terms of what is America. We have done this again and again and again. My name comes from my grandmother, who was Italian. The family, when they came here in the 1880s, was named Castelvici. But as soon as they got here, they changed it to Castine because Italians couldn't get a job. Italians were not welcome. You know, my father is Irish. Hassett is actually Irish. In the Hassett family, once the patriarch got here, Michael, there were no Michaels or Patricks in the family. He decreed there would be no boys named Michael or Patrick because Mick and Patty were slurs. And so none of his family were going to have those names, no boys. And so, you know, my question always is, what are we going to learn? So I guess I would, back to the dinner, I would have each person talk a little bit about their story, their ancestry, and see if I couldn't get the conversation to be about when we're going to learn.
Who would you invite? Who's important? Isla, who do you think should come?
I would be more than happy to, first of all, have like a personal conversation with whomever have fear or have concerns about immigrants and refugees. I would love to be on that dinner table myself because I always feel like when people feel nervous when I introduce myself, hi, my name is Ayla, I'm from Syria. When they get scared, I really want to invite them to lunch and talk to them and tell them about myself and where I come from and tell them that, you know, Syrian people are not that scary. We all are normal people like you guys. We have dreams and hopes and fears. Most of us, we have 11 million displaced people internally and outside Syria, and most of us share one dream. I can tell you that for sure. We dream to be able to find a job and live next to people who, like, our loved ones. Most of us are, like, most of my friends and my family are scattered all over the globe. They're either struggling finding a job or they're struggling because they're away from their families. So I would like to, on that dinner table, I would like to talk about that and tell that we contribute, we work, we pay taxes, and we contribute building our communities. And I... you know, hoping that this person leaving the table, I want to tell him that immigration and asylum and coming here as a refugee is an extremely difficult process. My uncles came in 1982. We got the approval in 2005. This is how long it takes. Like the vetting and investigating the background, it takes a long time. So if a bad person want to come, it wouldn't be very smart for him to come as a refugee because it would be not a very smart decision.
That's definitely a good message for our guest. Larry, we want you to do the lighting, of course.
Of course, but of course.
More than that, would you give the president a piece of your mind, or would you be more subtle?
Around, but, yeah. But I would. I think I'd frame up the dinner by this. I would go to I guess the first rule would be all conversation has to be over 140 characters.
Oh.
That would be one.
Oh.
Number two is it would be in a non-branded location.
I see.
Okay.
All right.
But I do have great reverence for the office of the president.
Would you invite any of your workers to come?
I would have it at a refugee or immigrant's home. And
That's a great idea.
And I would have them there to talk to the president. And then I would allow him, hopefully, to make a judgment that I don't think he's experienced. And I'm assuming that that opportunity may change him, or what I perceive his view is. I would like to give him the opportunity to walk down a different direction that I perceive he's moving now.
Well, I only say that not to confront or criticize the president in any way. There are plenty of people doing that. But, you know, I think when you hear collectively the spirit in which you offer these ideas and messages and particularly your experiences, that this is persuasive. I mean, this is not hard to grasp. Mm-hmm. I don't think this is a huge, leap for Americans once they hear it. And, a lot of people say, and some of them are immigrants who've spoken to me, that the media is to blame here on some level, that the media is a problem. Eva?
I think the media is a whole nother topic. I think that certainly, I feel like the media, the orientation of the media has changed, or much of the media has changed from the campaign to now. I think that during the campaign there was a lot of repetition and a lot of, I don't really know what exactly was motivating the coverage necessarily. It wasn't facts. I mean, if you can't tell, I pay a lot of attention to facts. And for instance,
how silly of you.
There's
out of fashion. It's so last Thursday.
There is no basis for saying that refugees are terrorists. There is no indication. There's no data that connects those two things. And yet, look what we had. There is, Ayla said, refugees are not pouring over our borders. It is not true that we do not know who they are. We know who they are. They are not pouring over our borders. They are already extremely vetted, 2-3 years of vetting. Ask a refugee. So I think, or ask someone who works with them. I think that journalism could do better at asking itself, perhaps to think about those facts. And I know that's difficult. But
I wonder how difficult it is because, we come here to Buffalo. We've been to communities all over the United States to try to get out of Washington and New York.
Right.
And I think at the sort of federal level, sometimes I feel as though, that's where the myths kick around. But you come to a community, and in Buffalo, there's a lot of facts here. Do you think Americans are focusing more locally or ought to be, or the media ought to be focusing more on local communities? Larry?
I want to step back a second because the word media to me is way too broad. I think we need to unbundle that. If we're talking about social networking, that's a social conversation. If we're talking about journalism where people have been trained and deliver news and factual news, and they have an educational system that supports their profession, that's another element. If we're talking about social commentary, where we have people on TV, the proverbial talking heads, that's another portion of that scope of media. And where I think the problem is that we bundle all that up into truth, or where we're gathering our facts. And I believe that people are smart enough, once you pause, to say, I understand each conversation, and I need to weigh each conversation and derive from it what I should.
But on all those platforms, why does a community like this even get missed? I mean, why overlooked? Perhaps, once in a million years you're going to hear about Buffalo. Every weekend, of course, you'll hear about the Bills. But again, I think you know, there's a kind of you know, in the blimp, flying over, and maybe it should land sometimes.
I think Buffalo, again, in the media about immigrants and refugees, we've had international exposure.
That's
in
great.
Terms of how welcoming a place we are, what a good place we are. We had somebody from the Department of State here. We had Samantha Power here from the UN. So we've had actually a lot of attention, and I think we deserve it. And that's not just because of organizations. It's because of people who help refugees and immigrants, too. I do think that sort of down on the ground, people get it differently. I guess that's a less sophisticated way of what you're saying. I think that whatever's on CNN with the talking heads, we've started to figure out there's always going to be one head that's for it, one head that's against it, and one head in the middle, right? But down on the ground, I think we kind of know better. And so I really think the more that we all can work together to make opportunities for someone to meet an immigrant or someone to meet a refugee. We have a program called Welcoming Buffalo at the International Institute. We engineer neighborhood cleanups and potluck dinners and very casual ways that somebody who's never met somebody from Syria can meet them, can clean up the neighborhood with them or sit at dinner. Isla was at our potluck a month ago. And just get to know each other. And that is the most powerful thing in terms of changing people's perspective, is just to, are you really from Syria?
Yeah, I sometimes feel like people want to
really
touch me.
Yeah, she's to see. Yeah. Like,
I didn't think
you said you said at one point that if you had a GoPro camera on your head, Isla, that people's reactions would be amazing to see. We've got to wind it up here, unfortunately. We could go for a half hour, but I'm going to give each of you 1 minute to sell Buffalo to the audience of 2.5 million who are listening to this. You've got a chance. Sell this community and sell the experience that immigrants are having because of your work and what's going on here. Larry, why don't you begin?
I've lived here all my life. I've traveled the world. I think it's an extraordinarily beautiful place that you can become well-grounded in. And I think that the moral and ethical tone of the city speaks for itself. I think it speaks through the voice of the immigrants and refugees that are now here. We don't have the best sports teams. We got great food. And come visit.
Isla?
For me, Buffalo is my second home now. I really want to tell this country that Buffalo gave me back my confidence. Now I believe that I can do things, despite my background. When I first came here, I felt like I have to apologize after saying I'm from Syria, or I have to break the ice telling a joke. But then, Buffalo, like all the support from my professors, from my supervisors, from my mentors at work, they gave me back my confidence. And they do have great food. They have a lot of Mediterranean places, and they gave me a voice through this program and through the International Institute. A lot of other interviews helped me convey and make people less scared and less stressed out when they hear that this person is from Syria. So they gave me a voice, and I don't take that for granted.
Eva, take us out here.
You know, it snows a lot here. And
it's the first mention of snow in this entire interview. I love that.
When it snows, but even when it doesn't snow, people from Buffalo help each other. People from Buffalo you know, dig your car out of a snowbank, people from Buffalo, check and see how you're doing. I know people in Buffalo who are teaching refugees from Burma English in exchange for learning some recipes for Burmese food. You know, this is going on all over. Churches in Buffalo are helping people who don't have places to sleep. Buffalo has this huge heart. And I think that, you know, that's true even when it's not snowing. And that's what counts. And that's what I want us to think most about here, and I want to support in myself and in each other. And I think that's what makes people want to come here, want to stay here, want to contribute here. And that's really the vision that I have for this place, is that our hearts are what's in charge, and we value each other, all of us, you know, born wherever, in whatever circumstances. That's a community.
It's a Buffalo thing. It's an American thing. Mm-hmm. Thanks to all of you, and thanks to the panel.
Thank you.
Thank you. Wow. Insightful. Just really, really good stuff. Thank you so much to Eva Hassett, to Ayla Abiad, and to Larry Crist. We really appreciate your input, and you know WBFO is going to be talking to you many times in the future. Thank you very much. Here's a little, for the price of your admission, a tip from TV studio experts. You sit on your suit coat so you don't look frumpy.
I just look frumpy.
Well, I was going to say, my response is journalists are supposed to look frumpy, right? So just an amazing panel discussion. I want to get back to the journalism aspect.
Sure.
Because it's funny, you mentioned it, and Wired.com is one of the many media platforms that has sort of espoused the demise, or at least the decline, of journalism. An article just recently, the headline screamed, "Journalism fights for survival in the post-truth era." The lead sentence, "The media is in trouble." Talk about declining ad revenues, trust at an all-time low, according to some polls. Should we be thinking of late-stage career changes, culinary arts maybe?
Well, I mean, I am not advising my children to go into journalism, at least not in the way that I've experienced it, because the pathway to journalism and to a successful career, you know, in this field, the one that I took, no longer exists. But I think that this is a time of great experimentation and huge participation in the media on the part of people who are trying out and exploring these new platforms and these new connections. I mean, the media has always been a way for communities to reach out and express various things to each other. And just as there are shouters and screamers and criers and, you know, myth makers and, you know, people who believe in alien abduction, there are, you know, people who want to know more and people who want to share more and people who have particular problems that they want to solve. And the modalities of connecting to do what it is you need to do is called the media. And as Larry pointed out, it's a very broad and getting more broad by the minute experience. And I wouldn't even say it's a business anymore. It's an experience. And no longer is the media a set of vertical institutions that have various badges of authority, like the New York Times, which will continue to exist, CNN, which will continue to exist, the networks will continue to exist. But, you know, there's more and more competition. I mean, people, you know, said that, you know, books would go away when, you know, magazines came into existence and that television would get rid of all print. And, you know, it's just not the case. All media competes, but media doesn't cannibalize other platforms. I think they continue to exist, but it is the you know, there's no guarantee of you know, infinite wages. I mean, you know, Brian Williams, before he got caught in his little storytelling fiction problem, you know, was making you know, $10 million a year. I mean, Bill O'Reilly, who we discover has some issues, you know, leaves with $25 million at Fox. You know, there's a salary cap in journalism, and I think people have to understand that. But that's not to say that people can't be really, really successful. And I think podcasts are a sign that, you know, there's a lot of exciting things going on in the media right now. I'm not worried.
And it's interesting because when we were talking earlier this month and I asked you, you know, what chapter in your globe-trotting life, all those countries, all those different things you've covered, what defines your career? And you talked about how you think maybe right here, right now is that time.
I mean, I think you have to assume that the best and most defining years, you know, might be what's happening right now. I mean, people always ask, what's the story that you love the most? I mean, I can go back to some stories that were particularly meaningful to me, but they don't involve big stars and they don't involve wars and they don't involve, you know, huge events. I think the thing that's most satisfying about journalism is that you are in a position to witness and to attempt to make sense of changes. And I think what we are experiencing right now is a huge shift in civilization that's going on. I mean, it's not too much to say that. I think, you know, at the end of the Cold War, so many writers were talking about how, you know, communism is dead and socialism is dead. And really all that's going to exist from now on is liberal democracy. And that's really where everything is headed. And there's sort of an incremental kind of line that's going to eventually encompass the entire world. Well, you know, nothing could be farther from the truth. Liberalism is being challenged right now. The questions of what the 21st century will be about, whether it's authoritarian regimes, whether it's a sort of social networked, you know, post-nationalism, where people don't live in countries, they live in sort of communities that are part virtual and part real. We don't know the answer to any of this, but the questions are absolutely fascinating. I think it's so interesting that Wired, you know, loves to talk about, you know, coding is dead, journalism is dead, the internet is dead. I mean, that's always on their cover. I mean, they need to sell magazines. I'd rather ask the question, what's alive? You know, and there is so much that's being born. And I just find this, I mean, religion competing with science. I mean, the whole climate change debate is not simply about science versus, you know, conservatism or, you know, religious mythology. Climate change is about world governance. Can we figure out world governance? Because that's what it's going to take to control climate change. Climate change, if the Earth survives, and nuclear weapons are the tests of whether we can solve and globally govern ourselves, because, you know, no individual nation is going to be able to solve that. And that's a fascinating, it's a first step to global governance. And, you know, then we go off to another galaxy and, you know, it's Star Trek after that. But that's what's going on now. I love that. I think it's fantastic. Yeah.
Another aspect of your life that we haven't touched on yet, you are a very vocal, very passionate advocate for people who have disabilities. And I've read some of the stuff that you've written over the years. You talk about this link between folks who are confronting these challenges and creativity and reinventing life, essentially. And, of course, you know, you've lived that firsthand. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, in the beginning of my disability career, which began when I was 19 years old, about 41 years ago, and I, you know, was in a car accident, and, you know, I was hitchhiking. I went to sleep in the back seat of the car. The driver went to sleep in the front seat of the car. The car went over a 200-foot embankment on Route 80 in Pennsylvania. And when I woke up in the car, I could tell that I couldn't, you know, feel my knees, and that, so therefore I must have a spinal cord injury. And, you know, the car was on fire. The two people who were driving, I mean, the driver and a passenger died. My roommate was unscathed. We were going to visit his girlfriend. So, as my mother said, the lesson from this is, well, you shouldn't have been hitchhiking. You know, try though she might to link it to some sort of behavioral deficiency on my part. It was, in fact, a huge random event that caused me at age 19, when teenagers, A, think they know everything, and B, also know nothing about their future. And so they're filled with questions, but a lot of bluster. Energy meets ignorance. Thy name is teenager. And I suddenly had a job to do, and it was, you know, get up, learn how to roll around, learn how to drive again. Learn, you know, there were all kinds of things that I had to learn. So my life suddenly had a purpose, and that was really important. And then as I became a journalist, I was very terrified to travel around the world. I didn't know what would happen. I didn't particularly think America was accessible, but I imagined everywhere else would be much worse. And what I discovered, because as a person in a wheelchair with a spinal cord injury, you know, if you're going to compete with people who are able-bodied, you have to, you know, realize that, all right, all right, if we're all going to the same restaurant, I got to figure out if it's accessible. You know, if we're going to be somewhere for a period of time, you know, I got to know where the bathrooms are, what the deal is with that sort of thing. I can't assume that things are going to work for me. I have to basically come at the world with a sense of skepticism that the infrastructure is not on my side. That's just not the way Americans view the world. I mean, Americans, if you pick up the phone and the dial tone isn't there, you know, not that anyone has a wired phone anymore, but, people go, what? Oh, for heaven's sakes. And that was certainly the case in the 70s. I mean, in America, you know, just stuff works. And when I went to the developing world, I was immediately bonded with most of the population of the world who, you know, wake up in the morning and maybe there'll be power, maybe there won't be, there will be food in the grocery store. No, I don't know. Maybe there will. You know, the expectation was, in a few hours, the power will come back. Have some tea. And this is what most of the world is experiencing. This kind of stuff doesn't work. So, you know, we'll deal with it. And I just, first of all, it was so comforting to be bonded, to still be an American, but to have this feeling of, like, oh, I understand what's going on here. And then I come back to the United States after living overseas for as long as I did. And what I discovered is that an ability to improvise, an ability to kind of get beyond this idea of normal and work with what you have to solve the individual problems, as opposed to floating through life in this American kind of rubber room that we live in where everything's so easy. I suddenly had all these skills that, you know, a lot of Americans didn't seem to have. And what was valued as the Silicon Revolution began to take place was this creativity and design, you know, thing. And this huge confluence in my life, and you can see it, I talk about it in a TED talk, but, you know, my dad was an industrial designer. I had no idea what he did. He couldn't explain what he did because he was a designer. I mean, designers are just, I'm designing, you know, this is all I can say. I mean, architects are kind of the same, you know, I'm sure Isla knows, you know, what are you? I'm an architect. I architect, that's what I do. You know, you can't really explain it. And so as a kid, I didn't really know what he did. He had really interesting tools. So he brought great stuff home from the office, weird models and things that we used as spaceships as kids, but I didn't know what he did. But I understood what design was when I came back to the United States and realized that this creativity we were valuing in America suddenly again was actually this innate quality that if you're disabled, this is what you use every day. And I think it was such a feeling that, wow, I don't need to think of disability as like, oh, gosh, it's great that you didn't die. How are you doing, Mr. Still Sick in the Wheelchair kind of thing? You know, this sort of medicalized idea of disability. It'll be okay. There might be a cure for you someday. You know, all the things that just have no meaning to me because I'm living my life. You know, suddenly all that went away. And I realized people with disabilities actually are ahead of the game. You know, there's a way for them to think that they know more. And is there a way for the disability expertise, the disability problem solving? I mean, there's 70% unemployment among disabled people. You know, if that were to suddenly go down to 10% and people with disabilities had a way of entering into the economy. And, you know, I guarantee all of them aren't as obnoxious as me. But to be able to inject their sense of we can do it, I'm used to this improvising. I think it would be such a benefit for the economy. And so that's really, you know, that's kind of the lesson that I've learned. It's taken me 41 years, but that's kind of the deal.
Interesting. Very interesting. Now, we want to get to your questions. I just have one more. I think it's going to be a surprise to you. I learned this at lunch talking with John. I mean, we've watched him on television years ago. We've listened to him on radio for many years. We've read his books, his articles. How many of you were in the audience of his one-man show off Broadway? No one, I bet. Give us a 60-second synopsis of how this happened.
I did a show after I published my memoir, I got a great book deal after I came back to the United States, and it was kind of a Middle East story. It was kind of a personal memoir story, a disability kind of overcoming obstacles story. But it was, about a guy in his 30s, and I, thought to myself, there are a lot of memoirs about guys in their 30s, and there was a lot of stories in that book or stuff that I didn't even include in the book, which seemed to lend themselves to a kind of, stand-up show, funny things that happened in my life. And so what I did was I wrote and worked with a director very closely in New York, and we developed a script called Spokeman, which is about a 90-minute show off Broadway in 1996. And, it had a great run, about a six-week run. It was never intended to be. I was working for Dateline at the time, so you couldn't really run forever. And it was really about kind of demonstrating that someone with a disability physically could have grace. I mean, I was in and out of my chair. I can't do any of that stuff nowadays. But it was so wonderful to create a theatrical environment for a wheelchair. There's one thing that I'm so proud of that I came up with. I invented this frame thing, which had two big rollers on it that had these silent bearings. And it was like just underneath the stage. And there was a place where I would roll on stage at certain points in the show. And I could roll and the wheels would move, but I wouldn't move. So I could like fly. We'd have lighting cues and it was just, here I was going really fast. And so you'd get a sense of my physical sort of exertion, but I wasn't moving anywhere. And it was very profound. And I just had a wonderful time doing it. It was the hardest work I ever did. Absolutely the hardest work I ever did. And I think it taught me that, if you're going to do a performance, and I think about this every day on The Takeaway, if you're going to perform something, if you're going to really reach out and communicate to people, you have to remember you're not the caption. You're the picture. And doing theater teaches you that every second you've got to be intentional and reaching out, and you can't drop that ball for a second. And that's why I think, on a good day, The Takeaway is very different because it has a certain intentionality. There's a structure to the conversations that we try to deliberately do. They have, act ones, act twos, and act threes, and our cutters, our staff, are really great at making that work. But it's an ethos that we insist upon on the show. And, theater has taught me so much. And, it's not just to be theatrical or to monopolize the conversation or to be Chris Rock, although I wish I could be Chris Rock. I mean, he's got such great jokes. But, disability is kind of an ethnicity, and the spokesman was a way to kind of tell a lot of ethnic jokes about people with disabilities, as well as make this sort of ethereal, graceful, kind of transcendent idea about the human experience.
Okay, you talked about performing on The Takeaway.
Right.
Now, you probably know John did his show upstairs at WBFO today. How many of you heard it? Few people. Okay, good, good. Well, you probably then heard the segment where he sang a song, where he did a tune.
Well, it's
and
off,
he had his mandarin, and it was phenomenal. I'm going to put him on the spot. I think we should do a real quick little tune about Buffalo, about the Buffalo area. What do you think?
I did that on the show.
Well, I think that would be fun, though. I think it would be fun. I think it would be fun. Would you mind if we? I actually had someone come over and bring the mandarin here. We've got the mandarin.
A mandolin.
How many people would like to hear a mandolin? I'm sorry. Mandarin, yes.
It's a mandarin.
You know how much
mandolin.
I know about music.
Well, what I mean, I have nothing prepared. I mean, what are we going to
do?
Well,
what do you want to do? How about the Erie Canal song?
Oh, these are the lyrics for the
I've got an old mule, and her name is?
This is an abduction.
15 years on. Okay, we have got a chorus here.
All right.
We've got a chorus.
All right. Well,
with our mandarin.
Let's see. Mandarin. Yeah, I'll do it in mandarin. Yeah, exactly. All right. I learned this song as a little kid.
Think of it as karaoke. We've got the name.
I've got, let's see. Okay, here we go. I've got a mule and her name is Sal. 15 years on the Erie Canal. She's a good old worker and a good old pal. 15 years on the Erie Canal. We've hauled some barges in our day, filled with lumber, coal, and hay. And every inch of the way, you know, from Albany to Buffalo. Low bridge, everybody down. Low bridge, cause we're coming to a town. Well, you'll always know your neighbor, you'll always know your pal, if you've ever navigated on the Erie Canal.
Wow. Okay. Good job.
That bridge
Very
is challenging.
Good job. See, song and dance, too. That is just wonderful. I, first of all, want to have a special thank you to our sponsors, Buffalo Seminary and Roger Torrey Peterson Institute for Natural History. They didn't know we were going to sing, and I think they'll be very happy when they hear that. We also want to thank, once again, our panelists who were just phenomenal, Eva Hassett and Isla Abiad, and, of course, Larry Crist. We thank you. We learned an awful lot from them.
Oh, sure.
And I think we're actually going to do a little presentation.
Oh,
right? Yeah. Oh, we're going to do Q&A first? Okay, very good. Let's do that. We have got some excellent questions in the audience. Don't worry about being the first person. Let's get it rolling. Let's get it rolling a little bit. Oh, my gosh. Okay, we see some hands. We've got two people in the audience with microphones. They're going to hold the mic for you, and you're going to chat. Here we go.
Yes. Hi, John. I don't know if you recall, but I did about 5 or 6 programs with you with Heat in the late 80s.
Oh, my God,
90s.
Yes.
And what's my name?
I don't remember your name, but...
I remember yours. Chuck Culhane.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was wrapping up a
You're
long...
in prison, right?
Yeah.
That's
long
right.
Long stretch. And we did...
With Joe Richmond, you did that.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, for heaven's sakes. Chuck, you're looking fantastic.
Thank you very much. And I can say, I can't believe it's been almost 20, 30
it's
years?
It's a crazy amount of years, I know.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, you look great, and I listen to you all the time.
Oh, thanks.
And I'm still above ground, and you're doing great, man.
Oh.
I got a book for you, John, that I edited about women in prison, and I'll give it to you before you leave, I hope.
Oh, fantastic. Thanks so much, Chuck.
Yes.
Was a great character on Heat, which was a daily 2-hour entertainment show in the evening out of WNYC. And, I mean, we in some ways there are hints of Heat on The Takeaway, but we found such great characters to tell stories on the program, and Chuck was one. God, thanks so much for coming, Chuck.
Wow, yeah. There's another question right over here.
Hi, John. I heard you this afternoon say that Buffalo used to be like a way station on the way to Canada. I think you were hitchhiking.
Yes.
And so now you've had a chance to spend a little time. And what's your takeaway? What's your takeaway of Buffalo? And how do you think the country will see any changes in perhaps the way they view Buffalo as a result of your presence here and what you're producing?
Well, I don't know if our presence here will have any impact, but I do think that broadly speaking, whether we're talking about race or whether we're talking about America's economic history, people are reexamining the American story. And I think for a long time, communities like Buffalo and St. Louis were just sort of lumped into a Rust Belt story. That New York and San Francisco and Dallas and Seattle were kind of like these are the American cool places and where the hipsters go and all that sort of thing, and that the rest of the country was just this them. And I think that what we're seeing is that so many communities around the nation have turned a corner. They haven't solved all their problems. I mean, there's no problem solved in New York City, but they've escaped from this Rust Belt stuff didn't work out. There's a lot of empty buildings story, and have become something else. And they retain an identity that comes from the past. And they're building a new identity that I think the panel talked about, which is what the immigrant story is. But also there's a youthful churning of ideas. We can do stuff here in Buffalo. I think the Rust Belt story is part of what chased people away from communities. I mean, there are a lot of people that come to New York from places like Buffalo, and you want to say to them, go back. I mean, why would you spend $5,000 a month on rent? Why would you buy a box that's half the size of a bathroom in Buffalo for $2 million and call it a luxury condo? what's going on in New York and San Francisco is probably not sustainable. But there's such a, the frontier is in places like Buffalo. And I think that's a great, great story. And whether I'm telling it as a journalist or you're selling it as you do, Eva and Larry and Ayla, about your own personal experience, or whether something happens in one of these communities that's not, a tragedy or, some kind of, Live at Five story. There are great things going on in America that are happening in communities of this size. And, as we saw in the election, rural America was pivotal, was absolutely pivotal. Now you can say that, thank you for Donald Trump, rural America. But that's a very unnuanced way of thinking about, these communities that are shedding this nationalist story that Larry talked about and acquiring a fundamentally new kind of identity. And I think Buffalo is a great example of an America re-understanding its history and re-embracing an optimism about the future that's real, that's different from we're the greatest country in the world without really thinking about that. It has nothing to do with the military or our power. It has to do with what's going on the street, and it has to do with, your community members, and I think that's great. It's a Buffalo thing, and as I said, it's an American thing.
A couple other questions?
Hi, I'm Linda Lazaro, and I know that we have to be the change we want to see happen in the world as blind and disabled people. What do you see as a frontier for us? How can we get a foothold and get the dynamism we need? Because I see us hitting our heads against brick walls. And I don't want to despair about these things, and I don't want to be disparaging. But I want to make changes happen, and I want it to happen yesterday.
Well, I've been very lucky. And I could, Ayla talked a little bit about how lucky she was as an immigrant, having the capacity and, sort of wind in her sails that a lot of immigrants don't have. And the same is true for me. I'm extraordinarily lucky, both in terms of the insurance my dad had, the timing of my accident, the nature of my injury, and, my family's support all along. The disability experience is varied. I remember I did a story one time on a disabled ski event in New Hampshire. And I was asked to come up and take a look at the adaptive ski program in this place in New Hampshire. And I remember, you know, as a journalist, I sort of said to these folks, you know, well, hey, I'm not going to, you know, take a freebie from you, you know, just to go see some disabled folks. And, you know, I thought of it as some kind of like Jerry Lewis telethon sort of thing. And you know, it was back in the days when I was just in my own disabled world and there was no other disabled person but me. And I think that a lot of disabled people are having that experience, and there is an innate sort of difficulty of coming together as a community. And when I went up to that ski event, I remember it was fabulously transformative for me. You know, there were spinal cord injury people skiing, and there were, you know, amputees skiing, and there were all these people with these various expertise. You know, there's real hot shots skiing. But I remember we had a corn and lobster feed at the end of the whole weekend. And, you know, the arm amputees sat with the arm amputees and the leg amputees sat with the leg amputees. You know, it was like, you know, it was like the Balkans, you know, and as classic America, you know, the African-American students are over here and the, you know, Italians are over here. I mean, we have to figure out a way to get together to speak in one voice as a disabled community. That's one thing. Secondly, I think we need to project that disability has a culture. And part of what I was talking about, this idea of creativity, is projecting the disability culture. And that's hard to see, and it's hard to articulate, and people don't necessarily get it. You know, you say disability culture, people go, whoa, you know, I guess you have to say that because you would want to commit suicide if you were in a wheelchair, right? People do say that. People say that. That these ideas of being excited about your disability are adaptive coping mechanisms because your life sucks so bad. No, my life sucks so bad because you're making it suck because of the inaccessibility in America. That's what's going on. You know, it's just like what happened with civil rights. It's like, oh, it's too bad that you're black. You know, it's like, well, no, it's not too bad that I'm black. It's too bad that you don't understand that I'm a person. That's what you don't understand. And it's a story we have to tell again and again and again in America. And it's not just America. It's all over the world. And, you know, even in this idea that seems to be intuitive that, you know, okay, some people who are disability activists thought, great, the Civil Rights Act happened. Well, now it's the time for the Americans with Disabilities Act. But it turns out that a lot of people who are, you know, ethnic minorities who fought for their rights made the argument, well, look, I don't think it's fair to describe, you know, coming up from slavery as the same thing as, you know, being, you know, physically handicapped. They're not the same. You know, I don't want to see a parallel in those two stories. And, you know, that's sort of very frustrating because it keeps people from coming together. And I think that's part of the problem. The deaf community are hugely influential in terms of projecting a culture. If you go to Gallaudet University in Washington, D.C., you see an active deaf culture that has a language, that has a sense of activism, a sense of we belong in this world and we are, they're very, very together. But it is also the case that disability, you know, people with disabilities didn't survive for most of human civilization. And so this is a moment that is that is transformative. People are living with disabilities. Part of what the marker is for human development on this planet is our ability to sustain the lives of everybody at every sort of level of physical capacity, because people are going to live at various levels of physical capacity. Look at the veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. Triple amputees, single amputees, traumatic brain injuries, people with PTSD. The military views them as, all right, well, you've had this terrible experience, you've served, so therefore we'll give you some sort of compensation. No, it's harder than that. It's harder than that. We have to integrate people with disabilities into our communities. In America, the military is segregated from the non-military community, and people with disabilities get accessible houses, not because of any government program, because volunteers help them. It's the community coming together. You should go and see what happens when one of these disabled individuals, quadriplegic or someone with a traumatic brain injury, gets moved into a house. It's all private money. You can go. They happen every weekend. It's a house building. Basically, the people show up who are disabled, and if they have a caregiver or a spouse or a family, they show up in their van or whatever vehicle they have, and, you know, right at sunrise, the trucks start coming, and the builders are there, and the modular housing comes, and it's like a barn building in the Amish. I mean, I'm telling you, it's so exciting. The volunteer moms from the military families are putting the plants in the gardens and stuff. And by the end of the day or by the end of the weekend, there's a house there. And they go in and they have a little dinner together. And, you know, these are Americans kind of working together. But nobody knows that story in the United States. That has to happen on a national level for us to really be able to say that there's freedom in America. Because, you know, I'll just close on this. I woke up in the intensive care unit in a hospital in Pennsylvania. And, you know, the doctors said, you're lucky to be alive and you're going to be fine. And, you know, that world of the intensive care unit and the ER, you know, makes great TV. But people don't live in the ER. And for the doctors to say, hey, you're lucky to be alive and we saved you. They don't have an answer for 10 years from then or 20 years from then. What am I going to do with my life? What opportunities are going to exist is a problem, is a huge problem. You can't say, well, we saved you, you know, go on and live now. You know, if there's no opportunity to live, exactly. You can't get transportation. You can't, that sort of thing. So if all I did was disability activism, I would be a loud, angry mother. And I've learned through 41 years of disability life that there's a lot of hammering to do. And yes, there's reason to despair. And 70% unemployment in the disability community is unacceptable. And it is also true that if companies and, you know, it's no different than the immigrant story. If companies and, you know, individuals and communities made it their mission to be an integrated, disabled, and able-bodied community and accept people and figure out how to accept, because there's new disabilities all the time. Traumatic brain injury is a huge problem. Medicine doesn't have an answer for it. And, you know, there are people warehoused from the war in Afghanistan and Iraq that the story of this century is going to be what happens to those people. It's our responsibility. If we can figure that out, there's a lot of problems that we will be able to solve. And in fact, there is no problem that we can't solve. So disability is a marker for our success as a nation and as a society.
It's a waste of resources.
Yep. That's right. That's right.
Minimum wage.
All of the above. All of the above. So don't you wish you were disabled now, Brian? See, because we're cool.
You're an amazing advocate. This is really an important discussion to have, and not to let it stop. I think we have one more question.
Yep, this is our last question.
Okay,
I have two questions that probably require a simple answer, and one that is a little bit more involved.
Go for it.
Where were you born and raised?
Dayton, Ohio, but I'm an IBM brat. My dad moved around. I lived in Dayton, in Rochester, in Syracuse, in Poughkeepsie and Armonk, and then in Western Michigan, which is where I sort of came of age in Grand Rapids, Michigan, home of Gerald Ford, by the way. And I went to high school there and then went to college in Chicago. So I'm kind of a polyglot of the Midwest and upstate New York, east.
My wife was born and raised and went to high school in Grand Rapids as well.
Ah!
Second question is simple. I know Pennsylvania well. I'm curious, where on Interstate 80 did you...
Clearfield.
Clearfield
exit. Yeah. It was just before the Clearfield exit on a piece of the road back in the 70s. That was not well maintained. It was a big story in the 1970s, the lack of maintenance on Route 80. And in fact, the reason we flipped over the guardrail was because of a badly constructed and badly designed and badly engineered guardrail. And we won a damage settlement. It wasn't huge, but we won a sizable damage settlement from the you know, it was like a six-figure, you know, very helpful to me, believe me. But the most important legacy of that is that it really changed the way in which roads were engineered in Pennsylvania and around the country. There's now a federal standard for guardrails that didn't exist. I'm not saying that my accident caused that to change, but certainly it was my experience and others like it that changed the standards for design and engineering on the roads in the United States. Sure, go.
As an abled person, I'm attentive to improvements on the behalf of the disabled, but you experience them. How far do you feel we've come in the 41 years, and how far do we still have to go, especially in terms of helping enabled people, or fully, whatever the right term is? Help us understand how much further we still have to go based on your 41 years of experience.
I would say that, you know, there's been a huge number of things that have changed in terms of specific accommodations. You know, 41 years ago, there were a lot of things that were hard. A lot of those things are easy today. And partly because I kind of get the system and can game the system. I mean, I live in New York, which isn't the most accessible city in the world. But I know how to game the, you know, for instance, don't get on a subway that only has one elevator on the line, okay? Because if you get on the line, you know, there were times when certain subway lines in New York only had one elevator, which was kind of like a trap for people in wheelchairs. You know, you put an elevator there, people in wheelchairs are going to go, hey, this is fun. But if there's only one elevator, then you get on the elevator and there's no way to get off. And so, you know, I would imagine, why did they do this in New York? You know, that maybe they were doing something with people in wheelchairs, you know, converting them into fuel or something like that. I didn't know. But those kinds of things have changed. The obviously stupid things have changed. And so now we're in a situation where there is a bare minimum infrastructure so that you can live a, you know, it requires energy, but you can live a productive life, I think, in cities like New York. And there are, you know, a lot of communities in the United States that are just really successful, sort of Swedish successful in terms of accessibility. And that's a great thing. Where I think we are, why I would say we are at the beginning, though, of what will eventually be the case, I think, when we get this right, is that the door hasn't opened broadly for inviting people with disabilities into the community. It's still viewed as some sort of odd, special thing. And the reason I say that is because, you know, travel to Mexico City sometime. First of all, because Mexico City is just one of the greatest places in the world. But if you go to the airport in Mexico City, you land and you go into that airport and you realize immediately this is a radically different place. All of the service personnel in the virtually all of the kind of service give you information, not the TSA, but sort of virtually everybody who's involved in delivering services and just giving general information at the airport are people in wheelchairs. So, you know, you go to the Mexico City airport and you look around and you think, oh, gosh, there must be some festival, you know, going on. I guess there's a, you know, the Paralympics is happening here or something like that. Or there's some sports team who arrived. And, you know, that just shows that I'm conditioned to think that, you know, there must be something wrong if that many disabled people are around. And what I realized, you know, spending time in the Mexico City airport is that that's the hurdle. You know, that's what has to change. That it's not unusual. And it's not unusual in Mexico City to see people in wheelchairs and to see people with disabilities. Someday that will be the case. And that's not to say there will be lots more disabled people and that I yearn for, you know, people in wheelchairs to sprout from some, you know, spinal cord injury producing experience that's going to, you know, make my brothers and sisters kind of come out of the, you know, wheelchair birthing room or something. That's not something I want, and I don't think it's what anyone would want. And indeed, I mean, I think in the beginning in American history, the white Americans thought of assimilation for African Americans who came from slavery or who or thinking about Native Americans, there, you know, the Thomas Jefferson understanding of what, you know, assimilation meant and mixing meant was, in fact, they wanted blacks to be white people, to actually behave like white people, and to acquire the language of white people and the identical education of white people. And if they weren't that, then there was something wrong. And what we've discovered is that, you know, whites and blacks have different experiences and different ways of expressing themselves, and that real mixing involves accepting those differences, embracing those differences, celebrating those differences, but having a common language. That's harder. And so I don't want everyone to be disabled. Well, some people I would wish would be disabled, you know, when I'm in a bad, really bad mood. But no, I don't want all people to be disabled, but I want everyone to recognize the experience of disability as not foreign. And that's no different than anyone has asked ever in the United States. And we know how to get there. You know, sometimes I think in America we don't try hard enough. And that's what I think needs to happen.
Excellent. So. Very good. Excellent questions. Excellent questions.
Thank you, guys.
So, John, before you go, we always like to give a little gift to everyone who comes to Buffalo.
Sylvia, I knew you had some.
That's right. Yeah. And this is the brainchild of our president and CEO. He always suggests that we do this gift, and it always is a big hit. It's for you.
Get out of town.
Now, we will mail this to you so you don't have to take it home with you. So, but no.
It's even in tune. Oh, that is
we don't
so
give shabby
sweet.
Gifts in Buffalo.
You guys are incredible. A musical key to the city of Buffalo, Niagara, presented to John Hockenberry, The Takeaway, April 25th, 2017. I even have a place to put this in my office. I have a guitar stand in
wow.
my office. That is so
oh,
great. Thank
great.
You.
Thank you for coming.
Wow.
Wow.
Well, that is just
great.
Isn't that a fitting gift?
Wow.
It's just,
exactly.
It's wonderful.
Amber, do you believe that?
Woo! And speaking of Amber, we've thanked our sponsors, of course, Buffalo Seminary and Roger Torrey Peterson Institute for Natural History. We thanked our excellent panelists. Someone we haven't mentioned by full name is the planning producer for The Takeaway. We have talked dozens of times in the last few months. Amber Hall, who does the magic behind the scenes. Way in the back there, waving her hand. We really thank you. Thank you for all your work. This has just been great. Now, John is going to move to the back of the room, meeting and greeting folks, autographing his excellent book. Don't forget, you can pick up a copy of the memoir. It's called Moving Violations, War Zones, Wheelchairs, and Declarations of Independence. That's for $15 pledge. You can get the nerd mug and the book for $25. And please remember to tune in to WBFO tomorrow at 2. You'll be hearing some familiar voices. And we thank you for being not only an attentive audience, but a wonderful, wonderful chorus. And thank you for joining WBFO. John, thank you so much.
This is really
this has
terrific.
Been wonderful.
This is
thank
so
you
great.
Very much.
Thanks. This is great.
Take care. Thank you.
All right.